UK Wine Show, show number 197. Tim Hannay on Perceiving Wine. G'day, my name's Chris Scott and welcome to the UK Wine Show. This week we're talking with Tim Hannay on how people taste and perceive wine. I'm actually putting this show together while I'm in Brisbane. I've been in Hong Kong for quite a while now and doing loads of really interesting interviews, getting the handle of Hong Kong and China. Okay, let's crack on with the show, and before we get into the news, we have our mystery grape variety. So here's the first clue in our grape variety. As usual, I'm going to give you two sets of clues, one now and then one just before the interview with Tim Hannay. And I'll also give you the answer at the end of the show. Our mystery grape is a traditionally southern Spanish grape. It's found in Andalusia, where it's used to make dark, raisiny, ultra-sweet, fortified varietals of the same name. Legend has it that it originated in the Canary Islands, where a little of it still grows. It was supposedly taken to the Rhine and was then brought back to Spain and eventually back to Jerez. A small amount is planted in Australia, seemingly, although I've never heard of it there. Have a think about that, because next up we have the news, which is going to be read by me since Jane's in the UK and I'm half a world away. First up news item is that children's charities are backing minimum pricing in the UK. Children's charities in Scotland have joined forces to back plans to introduce minimum pricing for alcohol in order to protect children from the harmful drinking by their parents or carer. The NSPCC's Childline Service, along with other charities, have issued a statement to the Scottish Health and Sports Committee urging policies to put children's interests at the heart of alcohol policy. Proposals by the governing Scottish National Party to enforce minimum pricing have been strongly opposed, but Childline say that harmful drinking can dominate family relationships and affects children's well-being. I think everybody knows my views. I actually don't have a problem with minimum pricing, as long as it's not too low and it's not too high. There's some pretty terrible pricing out there where wines and alcoholic beverages are given away to encourage toilet roll sales and the like. So a minimum pricing, I think, is good. Certainly doesn't seem to work by putting up the duty. I think if I had a choice between minimum pricing and duty increases, I would take the minimum pricing every time. The next one is sort of in the same lines. It's a bit of a week for it. Pernod Ricard accepts responsibility. As part of its Accept Responsibility initiative, Pernod Ricard the UK has launched a campaign to tackle underage drinking by encouraging parents to play a more active role in educating their children about alcohol. The Accept Responsibility campaign targets three issues associated with alcohol: drink driving, pretty bad stuff, binge drinking, again not the best, but we've all done it, and the latest phase, underage drinking. The company says it recognises the underage drinking is an important issue to address, but adults with children need to understand that they have a key role to play. And the last story, which is a bit more upbeat, Tim Atkin, Master Wine, has moved with the times. You may recall last week we said that Tim Atkin's column in the Wine Observer was going to be cut back. The Times swooped in and appointed Tim as their new wine writer in the paper's new Thursday food and drink supplement. The first column appears on Thursday, the 4th of March, and Tim will write the last column for the Observer at the end of March. That pretty much ends the news this week, so you don't need too many comments from me. I think these are all pretty straight up and down. But let's get stuck into our next bit of information, which is our book review. You may recall last week I said that I was hopefully going to try and finish reading Natalie McLean's book, Red Wine and Drunk All Over. Well, I did manage to finish it on my travel, so I'm quite pleased to say we're going to be listening to Natalie McLean's Red, White and Drunk All Over. Natalie describes her book as a wine-soaked journey from grape to glass on the cover, and I sort of agree with her. I thoroughly enjoyed the book, even though it's definitely pitched in at the beginner, but wine fans will enjoy reading it as well. Unlike many educational books, it feels more like a novel with a cast of characters from the wine industry. Natalie chats with a range of industry experts while interleaving some excellent content, although nothing particularly new. What is new is the way that you get a sense for the people, whether it's Randall Graham from Bonnie Doon, who's apologetic for not being French and making wines with no soul, his words not mine, through to Natalie experimenting on how to sell wine for a day made her feel. Occasionally, she's overly emotional, such as explaining when she burst into tears when served a corked wine and was too scared to stand up to an overly snooty waiter. But she's trying to identify with the newbie wine drinker and empathise with them, so I can understand that. What this book does is it gives lots of information about how the wine industry works, with plenty of tips and tricks, but how people feel and personal insights into something that you wouldn't normally get in a more textbook-orientated wine book. For example, how does a person serving you in the wine shop feel about your silly questions? Now, this may seem silly to winos, but it's reassuring to novices to know that the wine people get all sorts of questions, and it's their passion to educate that drives most, and as long as you're engaging, they love to help. There are some bizarre facts, such as in America, Costco is the largest US seller of Bordeaux First Growths, and that might help explain why Chateau and Estates owned by Diageo exited the Bordeaux on-premier market. Through the book, Natalie discovers a romance of terroir and the history of champagne. She has an excellent section on the differences of various wine writers and uses a spat between Jancis Robinson and Robert Parker over the 2003 Chateau Pave as the backdrop. A pragmatic view on wine glasses, she also explains her fears, joys and experiences trying to sell wine, being a sommelier and hosting a wine tasting. All are written with some great turns of phrase, such as describing a client while working in a shop as a thin, heavily made-up woman whose affections seem to be negotiable. I quite like that. It made me laugh quite a bit when I was reading it. While she was working for a day in a wine shop selling wine. If you're new to wine or even have a bit of knowledge, then I wholeheartedly recommend this book. It's a bit soppy in places, for sure, but it does give a true feel of the wine industry, and it gives you a feeling for the people in the wine industry as well, which most people in the industry say is the most important thing and why they get drawn into the industry. In the end, I rated this book 92 out of 100, and I would recommend it to someone who doesn't want to read a textbook, but really wants to learn about wine. Fantastic book. It did take me quite a while to read Natalie's book. I've been trying to read it for about 4 months now. And it's one of those things where I couldn't work out why. I got into the book. I really enjoyed it. But I kept putting it down and not picking it up. Hopefully, the next book I'm reviewing, which is The Billionaire's Vinegar, and I'm really enjoying that so far, is going to be finished in a couple of weeks' time. So I'll give you another book review coming up very shortly. But next up, we have our second set of clues in our mystery grape variety. So here are the clues again. This mystery grape variety, often referred to as PX, has a thin skin, highly alcoholic, rather disease-prone variety, is one of the classic Sherry's grapes, although it's becoming less common in Shiraz in favour of the more productive Palomino. Misleadingly, other countries have had this grape, but most have turned out to be varieties other than the PX of Spain. Okay, have we think about that? I know I've told you the initials, PX, but can you remember its proper name? I'll give you the answers after the interview, which is coming up next, with Tim Hannay. As you know, Tim Hannay is a master of wine and an expert on wine and food matching. We talked to him about how people sense and taste wine. Let's have a listen to what Tim has to say. Let's talk about what's going on in the mouth. We talked about umami, but there's other things that you talked about, bitterness, astringency, acidity and sweetness.
Right.
There's also, I always think of alcohol as like a pain receptor almost, as opposed to a taste receptor. Is that right?
Well, yes and no. So there's something called chemosensory response, and it's actually all sensations of taste and smell are chemosensory. But there's a certain group that are actually, we think they're tastes, but they're actually touch related. So what happens, alcohol itself doesn't burn. It's these small molecular weight phenolics, these bitter things in association with alcohol to hypersensitive people that burns.
Okay.
Tolerant people, alcohol tastes sweet.
Yeah, I know people say.
And then the hypersensitive people, it's like, how can you drink that crap? It's horrible, burning, and bitter. And one demonstration of it is try vodka, and it doesn't nearly burn as much as scotch or cognac because of the phenolics, the oak particles in the cognac are actually in combination with the alcohol, creating the touch sensation of burn.
Okay.
All right. Now, one of the things that we started to notice is why the hypersensitive tasters with more taste buds seem to be the ones who really dig the hot burning. And you know, the addicted people who are putting Tabasco on their scrambled eggs, and they just can't, they'll actually be sweating at the dinner table.
Yeah,
and
I've
loving
seen
it.
I've always thought of them just nuts.
They're nuts. Well, they're actually having orgasms.
They're just dirty nuts.
Dirty nuts, yeah, exactly. Now you can really resent those bastards. So we went to our scientists because we were observing, why in the world would this happen? And it's brain chemistry. When you have arthritis, typically you'll get a cream with capsaicin or capsicum in it. And when you put it on your skin, it actually irritates your touch nerve endings, and your brain sends chemicals there, and it actually is an anesthetic or an analgesic for the arthritis pain.
Yep.
And it's just because your brain sends the chemicals to that
region. Is that a bit like deep heat?
Yes. Yeah, somewhat. Yeah, menthol will do the same similar kind of thing.
And just for listeners, capsicum is green peppers.
Right. Well, in the hot burning chilies, for some people, create this intense burning that the brain immediately responds to by dumping these wonderful chemicals into the bloodstream. And it's literally the same type of chemicals and same exact chemicals and the same levels as having an orgasm. So these are the people who are just addicted. It hurts so good. And you just can't, you know, you think they're nuts if you're not getting it. But it's also runner's high is a similar kind of a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
All sorts of phenomena.
Are these the same sort of people who have a large amount of leather and whips at home?
Yeah, well, it is exactly that same thing. And so what happened, you know, we were talking about also, once your brain starts telling you that the steak and the red wine do this, you actually stop experiencing what happens. And just the thought of it will change your chemistry and whatever. And that's the anticipation of S&M, really. And, you know, the Pavlovian thing.
Okay, so alcohol, which is this heating, or not quite heating, is it?
It's different reaction for different people, and it's not necessarily the alcohol itself. It does something to sensitize the receptors, and then if you're hypersensitive to bitter, it the combination burns.
Okay, what about sugar? How do people detect sugar? Is it just a set of receptors in the tongue, or the tongue's got taste buds and papillae? What's the breakdown between those?
You know, I don't even know. What we have is we've got a different type of physical aspects of our tongue, and so we've got like fungiform papilla, and we've got circumvallate papilla. So see that crease on the tongue there?
Yeah,
that's circumvallate in there. So it's actually a different type. And then on those little round circles are the fungiform, because if you look at them from the side, they actually look like a mushroom.
Because I've done that blue tongue thing. We do it in some of our tastings just to talk to people about it. And I've noticed some people have got really crevassy type tongues.
Right.
They tend to be older people.
Right.
Is that true? Or
yes. Yeah.
Is that the circumvallate?
They've got valleys on their forehead and eyes.
And they're just getting wrinkly tongues.
And arse.
But then,
oh, we've got a poster child. This guy's got he looks like the Grand Chape. Canyon. Yeah, I know.
Chape dogs. Is that with their wrinkles?
The Alps. And just he's got taste buds on his nose. But anyways, yeah. So we've just got all these different, you know, things. And the more we learn about it, the more we don't know. So you've got fungiform papilla that the receptors are then a part of. And so it turns out, and I'm still learning about this myself, but you could have a fungiform papilla that might have 7 or 9 receptors, and somebody might have 20 on some of theirs.
The same receptors or different?
I don't even know. And again, because as we get these further, I'm not a scientist. I work with the scientists to see if I can kind of connect concepts so that we can have more fun with stuff. And every time I turn around, it's something new to learn and whatever. And the other thing is that even then, one single receptor on a papilla from one person to another could transmit at a much greater amplitude. So it turns out you might even have the same number of receptors, but perceive things at different intensity. So it'd be like, you know, having a microphone that you need to have the boost for, or one that has a higher signal, you know, so a low level or high level, you know, Z, yeah. You know, to the board. So that, you know, but it's very similar to that. So you've got certain taste buds for some people that send a much stronger signal or a weaker signal. You got way more papilla. You got way less papilla. You've got medium papilla, but more receptors on each or less on each. You know, so all these variables, yeah, okay.
So sugar and acidity, are they are receptors?
Yeah, those are primary tastes. Primary tastes are sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami.
Okay. And do they just work slightly differently in terms of the way they connect to the, you know, a bit of acidity hits your tongue? I always think of it a bit like a jigsaw almost, and you've got a receptor that sort of connects to...
Don't even go there. Yeah, that's a lock-in. Well, that's not all wrong, but they don't know. So one of the satisfying things is nobody friggin' knows. Yeah, so mechanisms and stuff. There's more and more understanding of the complete neurotransmission and the proteins. It's very, very complex. We love to try to simplify it. I've given up trying to simplify it. Actually, somebody shared with me some time ago that knowing is the lowest form of learning. And so I just figure I'm a great learner as long as I just say, I don't know.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Fair enough. We're at the Bibendum trade tasting at the moment, but there's a survey here. What are they trying to do?
Okay, so what we're doing is we want people to go to bibendumtimes.co.uk, and you'll see on the right-hand upper page the survey link. And share with us your preferences for salt and coffee and wine, and what words do you respond to or favor most, and what beverage do you drink at home and when you're out dining, and so on. And this is all part of an initiative to help the trade become smarter about you and about consumers, to custom fit wines rather than make these
assumptions.
Stupid assumptions and recommendations without asking. Yeah.
Okay. All right. And what are they going to do with that information? Is it just like say, well, 25% like salt and drink this? And
well, actually, what we're going to do more and more is use it as evidence that the wine industry, it's really time to change some of the way we do things. You know, and there's so much that works about wine. If you're passionate, if you've been to regions, if you know the wines you like and you found your way. But what we found in the United States, and we're certain we'll find it here, is well over 50% of all the consumers are just dumbfounded. They're confused. They're intimidated. It's like somebody speak a language I can understand. And so this is what we're going to use for those people to help just improve our service.
Okay. The other thing you're doing is you run a wine competition that's got quite a strange judging mechanism. Do you want to just touch on what you're doing?
Yeah, we're
there?
Doing something so stupid and preposterous. We're actually using everyday consumers to evaluate the types of wines they love.
What would they know?
I know it. They'll hurt themselves. You know, how could they? So it was just fabulous. We've actually invented a protocol with scientists that people just take a glass of wine. We form panels of people just who love a certain type of wine. And if you love Cabernet, then you'll, if you drink that daily, then that you'll get to evaluate that if you're selected. And we'll have a panel of five other people. If you love Pinot Noir, if you love Rioja wines, if you love Viognier, if you love Pinot Grigio, if you love White Zinfandel or Black Tower. So what's really fun is if you love Black Tower and White Zinfandel, the wines that will be judged by those people will be similar types of wines. And then when you get your taste profile and what we're doing with the Bibendum survey, we're actually setting up the mechanism that we can have consumer-to-consumer peer evaluations, not necessarily what experts say, but what people like yourself with your sensitivities, who like the wines you like, what do they like? And it's part of a whole global mission to create social networks and new affinities.
Okay. I find this stuff really interesting. Have you written a book, or have you got a website with lots of information on it, Tim?
No, there's a lot of books that actually lift my material and then take credit for it. It's too dynamic. Every time I turn around, I'm learning something more. I do have a blog, and it's swamiofumami.blogspot.com. And there's also a website called Taste SQ. So it's taste sensitivity quotient, So letter S, Sam, Q, Queen. And if you go there, you can take the whole sensitivity survey. And also, we're developing it more and more to create recommendation engines and communities of people. You can also get to it by going to yumyuk.com.
Yumyuk.
Yumyuk. Y-U-M-Y-U-K. And that's our simplest basis. Well, how do you like it? Yum or yuck? And then we invite people to then find the people that share their values. You may get hooked and passionate about wine or not. You just might love it, but you just want a consistent way and you want people to understand your needs, not try to push the wines they love as like it ought to fit your foot, whether it's your shoe size or not. Yeah.
Okay, brilliant. Then, Tim, I know you're very busy. Thank you very much
Absolutely
for your time.
Absolutely a pleasure. Thanks.
Cheers, mate.
All right. Bye-bye, Chris.
Hope you enjoyed that interview. That finishes our series talking to Tim about wine and food matching and how people taste wines. I hope you haven't found it too boring. I found it really fascinating, and I've been really keen to talk to Tim for quite a while now, ever since I did my research on umami and his name kept popping up. Next week, we're going to look at a bizarre thing. It's a closure, well, sort of a closure. It's a plastic layer you can add to both ends of cork to keep the wine free of TCA, but also, more importantly, to control oxygen ingress into the wine. I found it really interesting, and the product seems to be quite good. I've read a report from the Australian Wine Research Institute, and it looks like it's a good performing closure, particularly over the 2 years that the report was for anyway. So stay tuned for that next week. But before we finish up, how'd you get on with the grape variety? It was a PX, as we said, but the grape variety is called Pedro Ximenes. I know it's an X, not the Z, but that's how you say it, Pedro Ximenes. Here's the clues again. Misleadingly, several countries have grapes called Pedro Ximenes, but most have turned out to be other varieties other than the PX of Spain. Pedro Ximenes is traditionally a southern Spanish grape. It's found in Andalusia, where it's used to make dark, raisiny, ultra-sweet, fortified variety of the same name. Commonly called PX, this thin-skinned grape, highly alcoholic and rather disease-prone variety, is one of the classic sherry grapes, although it's less common in Shiraz in favour of the more productive Palomino. Legend has it that the PX variety originated in the Canary Islands, where a little is still grown, but it was supposedly taken to the Rhine and then brought back to Spain and eventually to Jerez by Peter Siemens, who was known as Pedro Ximenes, hence the name. He was a soldier in the Charles V's army. Pedro Ximenes is also grown in southern Catalonia, Valencia, and a small amount, though much less, is planted in Australia. Misleadingly, other countries have called grapes Pedro Ximenes, but most have turned out to be other varieties rather than the PX of Spain. That's the clues. Just to finish up before we have the show is this week's quote. Now, I took the quote this week from Natalie McLean's book, which I reviewed earlier, and I really liked it. So it's a quote by Natalie herself, and she says, "I've often been surprised by how much I love a certain wine in a tasting, and then later find it monstrously heavy with dinner. It's like meeting a person in a noisy bar who seems interesting, but when you bring him home, he doesn't lower his voice or shut up." So I hope you enjoyed that quote. I'd like to say she has a great turn of phrase, and I do recommend the book. So until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.